1986. And I think that this day will go down in history as being a pivotal point in the decision of the direction of mankind, really for the future of the entire of mankind. My name is Jessica Tremblay, and I have the great honor of introducing to you the greatest living American, Lyndon LaRouche Jr., and the greatest economist of our day. I'd like to welcome all guests gathered here in Berlin, this full room, and I'd also like to welcome all guests who are sitting in Washington. I know that there are hundreds of gatherings throughout the world today, and all of us are really anxiously awaiting the very wise words of Mr. Lyndon LaRouche. And the reason is the current financial system is disintegrating. Therefore, LaRouche is rallying those forces who are going to really represent and fight for the general welfare, be they in governments, be they in population. And I would like to say specifically also, especially thousands of youth throughout the world who are those who are looking to live the next 50 years and to give something great to posterity. So without any further words, I'd really like to very much welcome LaRouche, and I think we'll have a lot of fun today.
Thank you very much. You know, about the worst and best moments in history come to most people of the time as a surprise. And that is going to be the case with what's happening in the world now. We are now at the end of an entire period of history. During the middle of September, in the U.S. and other parts of the world affected directly by the U.S., there was the beginning of a new downturn in the world economy. This is somewhat complicated by the fact that there is an election campaign, so-called midterm election, now occurring inside the United States. And the party in power is losing power, that is, the losing power in terms of support from the people. It is preparing to commit great electoral fraud in the United States to try to keep some of that power. It is prepared to go to war to try to preempt the situation, the political situation, to retain power. But it also has long-term intentions to establish world dictatorship called globalization, which would mean a disaster for all humanity. Now, these events are coming rapidly. There are some good things happening in the world as well as these bad things. But they're coming together as often at the same time, as in war. A terrible war breaks out. People are prepared for war, but they don't know what war is. Then suddenly they get a taste of it, and it wasn't what they expected. And sometimes the war goes against the offender, and that's a good thing. That also comes suddenly, as surprising developments and mobilization of people and institutions mobilizes people to resist evil. The same is true of great economic depressions. Everybody is surprised by a great economic depression, even those who predicted it, because it doesn't come exactly as they thought it would when it comes. So that in terms of governments around the world today, as I know of them and know what they're saying, most governments of the world, including the governments we refer to principally today here in Eurasia, will be taken by surprise. In China, in Japan, in India, in Russia, they do not yet have any sense of what is about to happen. They have a sense of a crisis occurring, but they have dreams, they have beliefs that they believe they can control their situation by certain beliefs they're operating on now, and they won't be able to. Demands will be made upon them which will catch them by surprise. I'm not particularly surprised. I've got a pretty good idea of what's going to happen. And I'm also more optimistic because I know that the good thing about this crisis, and there are many bad things as well, the good thing is that what most people believe is going to be discredited. What most people believe they're going to find tomorrow, they no longer believe. It's going to seem to them that everything they believe is suddenly become untrue. They believe they know how to manage an economy. Governments believe they can cope with the economy. They're trying to postpone the crash, which is already coming on. They can't postpone it. They may delay it for a short period of time by another hyperinflationary inflection. Like in the United States. The United States economy is disintegrating. It's not collapsing, it's disintegrating. And the loss of the automobile industry in the course of the last year continued this year. The United States no longer has an automobile industry. It has some automobile plants in the United States, but they're no longer U.S. automobile industry. They're foreign-owned and foreign-controlled. The same thing is true of steel production in many parts of the world. All the essentials are no longer controlled by nation states and the people of nation states. And so people have illusions. Everything will be all right. Our government will handle it. The government of France, the government of Italy is not a government. It's death waiting to be buried. And this is characteristic of many parts of the world. So that's what's coming upon us.
Yeah, that's
now, the turn came, as I indicated earlier, in the middle of September, where the onrushing, long-standing decline in the world economy, which has been in the process of decline since about 1971, 72, actually. Some people were becoming rich, but at the expense of the other people. Economies were collapsing. You look at the United States. You look at the United States, every county by county around the United States. In virtually all counties where there used to be production, there is no more longer production. People are no longer living by high degree of skill. They're living as waitresses or waiters or other kinds of things, so-called service employment, largely make work, which is not even necessary. You don't cook a hamburger at home, you go out to a hamburger stand. You don't need that. So the economy has been disintegrating. But the upper 20%, particularly the upper 20%, which is now in positions of power, people generally between 50 years and 65 years of age, that generation lives largely in an illusion. They think their world has come. They think that this is a post-industrial society. They think that's good. They think globalization is good. Globalization is a disease that will destroy the entire planet and kill off the levels, most levels of population today. It's an empire. It's imperialism. It's a return to a caricature of what happened in Europe in the Middle Ages. And all these things are happening. And people are not prepared for the shock that suddenly is going to change. In the United States, the characteristic is, as I said, with the election campaign, the attempt to postpone the appearance of reality for just a few more weeks, hoping on the part of the Bush administration, hoping that they can deceive people, even though they're losing the election. Losing popularity, and hope that they can hold on to power for one more round. Many people believe, for example, that the evil is coming from the United States, but it really isn't. The United States is not the source of this problem. The source of this problem is right in Europe. It's in the Anglo-Dutch liberal establishment of Europe. And what we have in the United States is an extension of that, and we can discuss that, but an extension of that. And what the United States is doing is not trying to conquer the world. What the United States is doing is destroying the United States. To destroy a powerful nation, how do you do it? You induce that nation to discredit itself. You corrupt it. You lead it to discredit itself. It loses the confidence of its own people. It loses confidence abroad. It becomes desperate in trying to keep power. It makes mistakes, as the United States says. Look, for example, at Southwest Asia. Look at this war in Afghanistan. Look at this war in Iraq. Look at the spread of this same kind of warfare into other areas. The aim at Iran. The aim to break up Turkey, which is also on the agenda, as well as all Southwest Asia. The intention to break up Pakistan. The intention to break up India, the intention to disrupt China, the intention to start a conflict with Russia, as in Caucasus, Transcaucasia. The United States is key in doing these things. It's not the sole author of this mess, but it's leading in doing it. What is the United States doing? The United States, which 6 years ago was still admired by many in Europe and elsewhere, is no longer admired. The Bush-Cheney administration has destroyed the influence of the United States, its credibility throughout the world. The United States has destroyed whole sections of the world and is spreading that to other parts of the world. What is happening in the process as leading military figures in the United States, leading intelligence figures, leading political figures who understand these things, see the United States under Bush and Cheney destroying itself, then who benefits from the destruction of the United States? Well, who put this Bush-Cheney administration into power? Ask the gentleman in London how this was done. Because the goal is a name you know, you've heard. It's a name for a poison, but you don't think of it as a poison. You think of it as the inevitable. The word is globalization is inevitable. You cannot go back from globalization to the nation state. It's inevitable. But globalization is empire. Globalization is the lowering of the standard of living throughout the world. You take a plan in Germany, as in Berlin. Look at Berlin since 1992. Did Berlin benefit from the breakup of the DDR? In a sense, more freedom, but freedom to do what? Freedom not to work. Freedom not to be able to pay and support the city because the industry is taken away. Where'd the industry go? Sometimes it just disappeared. Sometimes the jobs were shipped to parts of the world where people are poor, where they have no infrastructure, where they have no health care. They work cheaper because their standard of living is much poorer. So what is happening is with the destruction of Germany, the destruction of the German economy, the Berlin economy in particular, under orders from London and France, the orders from Margaret Thatcher and Mitterrand, that Germany must destroy itself as a price of unification. The world becomes poorer. As the United States destroys itself, its economy, the world becomes poorer. Work is shipped to poorer and poorer sections of the world. Jobs were exported to Mexico. But Mexico's too high priced. They ship the jobs to Central America. The same thing is happening throughout the world. Employment in production is being shipped from areas of high degrees of skill and high degrees of conditions of life of population to poorer and poorer parts of the world. This is called globalization. It's the elimination of the nation state, the elimination of the protection, the standard of living, the health care, the educational systems, all these things are being destroyed. You have 10% of the labor force of Germany has no help, no hope, no future. Germany is being destroyed. Italy is being destroyed. Some jobs are going to China. All right, but let's look at this thing, this American empire myth. What happens if the United States collapses? Let's suppose that a collapse occurs as a 20%, 30% collapse in the valuation of the dollar. Does that mean that other parts of the world suddenly become better because they take over from the United States? No. If the United States goes under, the rest of the world goes under immediately and automatically. Why? In 1971, in August of 1971, the administration of that time, the Nixon administration, threw an individual called Schultz, George P. Schultz, the man who later put the dictator Pinochet into power in Chile, together with Henry Kissinger and Felix Rotten, floated the dollar. That is, up to that time, the U.S. dollar had been a regulated currency with a fixed parity system among currencies internationally. The dollar was still essentially as good as gold. It was the dollar which was the only world currency at the end of World War II. The power of the dollar, the stability of the dollar, through things like the Marshall Plan and similar arrangements and the fixed exchange rate system, enabled a recovery of Western Europe, enabled a recovery in other parts of the world through things like the Kreditanstalt für Wiederaufbau in Germany as vehicles for mobilizing credit to reconstruct the economy of war-torn Germany, to reconstruct the economy of France, to build up the economy of Italy, which continued into the late 1960s. Now, in 1971, the dollar is turned into toilet paper by an act of an administration. It is backed up in 1972 by a meeting of the International Monetary Fund. Again, George Shultz was there. We had a floating exchange rate system. What backed up the dollar? Well, no, the dollar was no longer a U.S. dollar. It was an IMF dollar, a U.S. dollar denominated in IMF conditions, with nothing underneath it, just good faith and trust that everything would be all right. Now, everything in the world today is related to this dollar. China has vast claims denominated in dollars. All parts of the world have vast claims denominated in dollars, assets denominated in dollars. What happens if the dollar collapses by 30%? Then China collapses. Then India collapses, because not only is the dollar worth less in their so-called asset list, but the collapse of the U.S. market and the chain reaction collapse of the U.S. market, its effect on other parts of the world, mean a collapse of the economy of India, China, and so forth, and also Europe. So a collapse of the U.S. dollar is a disaster for every part of the world. And people don't understand that. There are a few people in the United States who understand that. I think Paul Volcker, the former head of the chief of the Federal Reserve System, I think he probably understands that. I know a number of other leading people in the United States understand. You cannot devalue the dollar. If you devalue the dollar, you bring down the whole house of cards of the world system, because world trade is denominated and calculated in dollars. The largest portion of the claims, financial claims of the world, are denominated in dollars. If the dollar goes down, everything goes down. Therefore, you have to worry about what happens to the United States. Because only if the United States takes action with the consent and cooperation of other nations to make the dollar a fixed value of security, thus maintaining the credit system upon which the entire world depends at this time, only under those conditions can you avoid something happening to the world as a whole, which is comparable to what happened to Europe in the 14th century, when the Lombard banking system collapsed and Europe as a whole fell into a prolonged new dark age. The collapse of a dollar today in the world market would cause a collapse of the planet into a new dark age. And therefore, this is typical of what happens on the day of crisis. Suddenly you're faced with a point. A collapse of the dollar is about to occur. You say, well, the dollar is going to collapse. The rest of us will get by. China will do well. India will do well. Europe will find a way to manage. Russia will do all right. No. The whole world will go into chaos. It's one of those things that happen in a time of crisis, when people are taken by surprise and things they kept telling themselves were true are shown suddenly not to be true. And the survivors are those who wise up quickly and recognize that what they believe was a fraud, was a lie. Because people live lies. This is also a sophist culture. The post-war world has become largely a sophist culture. Europe, the United States in particular. We are sophists in the same kind of sophistry that led the Pericles Athens to destroy itself in the Peloponnesian War. That kind of sophistry. Words no longer have meaning. Truth no longer exists. Sophistry. But I don't know. You say it's true, but popular opinion says no. You say this is good, but popular opinion says no. Popular opinion says this is good, but you say no. What's your authority? Popular opinion. Or what you perceive to be popular opinion. Or some group's opinion. But a belief in something for which is not proven, which is not true. And that's the way civilizations are destroyed, especially European civilizations, ever since the fall of Athens under Pericles. Golden age of Athens. The golden age proved to be something flushing. And Athens went down the toilet. Golden age. And this is the way Euclid's collapse. Now let's look at the other side. That's the bad side. Not only we're in a period of war, we're on the edge of a threatened dark age, a collapse of the dollar, a collapse of the world. All of these things are now in process. Well, I said we have to defend the dollar. Let me explain that again, as I had recently some questions on this. First of all, the world is dominated, especially the world denominated in dollars, is denominated in a kind of pseudo-currency called financial derivatives, such as hedge funds. Now, what are hedge funds? What are financial derivatives? They represent gambling debts. There is no product in hedge funds. There's no product in financial derivatives. There's nothing physically worthwhile in them. What this is a bet. It's a gambling bet. And then it becomes gambling bets on gambling bets, where hedge funds compete in gambling against each other. The world has become one giant gambling casino ever since 1987, since Volcker left office at the Federal Reserve System and Alan Greenspan came in and invented and legalized what should be now outlawed as criminal practice called financial derivatives. And the world is now run and controlled by financial derivatives. And this is a bubble which is about to collapse. So what do we have to do? We have to get rid, the first thing we have to do is get rid of this paper. Cancel all hedge funds, all financial derivatives. Now, you get a big scream from some people when you say that, but you have to do it. You'll do it one way or the other. You will either do it in an orderly fashion, by actions of government and agreements among governments, or it will happen to you anyway. And if it happens to you anyway, it's going to come like a collision, not a decision by governments. Because we could never pay, the world could never pay to support the claims denominated in hedge funds, in financial derivatives generally. It couldn't be done. The debt is so much bigger than the entire annual product of the world. And particularly at today's interest rates, you could never pay it. So therefore, as long as you cling to financial derivatives and hedge funds, you're doomed. If your country supports them, your country's doomed. And we'll find a new government somewhere.
I'm here.
Maybe one that solves the problem, but it will be a new government, whether it solves the problem or not. There's a crisis will occur. Therefore, the first thing we have to do is we have to put the world into bankruptcy reorganization. We have to agree that the dollar must become, once again, a fixed exchange unit. Why? Because it's worth that? No, because we're going to make it worth that. We're going to shift the world economy by putting it through bankruptcy reorganization, like any ordinary, orderly bankruptcy reorganization. We're going to put the world financial system into bankruptcy reorganization. We're going to convert short-term claims, if they're viable, into long-term claims. We're going to operate on a low interest rate, as we did in the 1920s when the recovery was started in the United States. We're going to now recreate a banking system because we have to save the banking system. We can't save many of the bankers who are insane, but we can save the banking system because we need the banking system. The banking system is the method by which you handle deposits of people, by which you circulate credit, which you build up long-term credit for investment, that sort of thing. So the governments will have to intervene to recreate, in bankruptcy reorganization, a set of banks, often the same banks that exist now, to go back and do business in a sane way as opposed to the insane way we've been functioning recently. Because we need the banks, we need them to support the investments that are being made in local industries, so forth, and in personal accounts of citizens and so forth, and in local communities. So now we have to have a solid system of credit based on long-term credit, on the elimination of claims denominated in financial derivatives or similar kinds of things. Now we find that the world economy, particularly in Europe, as in Germany, for example, or in France, but take the case of Germany here, the problem is that there's not enough production, a productive employment, for Germany to be able to pay its taxes in order to have a stable country and to have growth. So the problem is a shortage of credit, because you have people who still have skills, and if they could be employed in back at their professions, if businesses could be started up which were useful, especially in industries like the industrialization of Berlin, then you could begin to have very quickly a recovery of the economy with sufficient credit and reorganization of finances. This is true in all parts of the world, more or less. Now, therefore, that means we need a new supply of credit, long-term credit, for that purpose. This all fits into a global picture. We have two parts of Eurasia. On the one side, you have European civilization, as it grew up in Eurasia since the time of ancient Greece, the time of Solon of Athens, for example. That European civilization, this has undergone with all its problems in between, here, twixt and before, with all kinds of developments. European civilization is a very solid institution. It may not be solid in the way it acts sometimes, but it's a very good idea. As a matter of fact, it's the most successful idea for the development and improvement of the conditions of life of populations. The nation state, as developed in Europe, is a form of institution, when properly developed, is the most efficient institution we know for promoting the improvement of the welfare of humanity. That's the case today. So therefore, we have, on the other hand, we have Asian populations. And Asian populations have been, until recently, until a development, a modernization development occurred, have been essentially treating the mass of humanity as cattle. Yes, some people are wealthy, some people have an impressive culture, some people have this and so forth, but the masses of people, 80 to 90%, are impoverished and living almost as beasts, with the life expectancies of beasts, the standard of living of beasts, enslaved, with no real development of the mind of the individual. The thing which in the best instances in Europe and the United States we had. So therefore, the problem is we now have come to a point, on this account alone, that we must think about the world. We have a growing population of Asia, a growing area of Asia. We have to think about recranking up European civilization with a mission orientation for the development of Eurasia as a whole over the coming two generations, which means that Europe must crank up as a source again of scientific and industrial output in the form of long-term credit, long-term investment in exchange with Asia to build up countries like the 70% or so of the poor of India, of the poor of China, of the poor of other countries, which where this poor, these poor have no future to speak of. And we have to have a mission of building up a just world based on cooperation among nation states with the Westphalian principle that we must think in all policies. We must think as the authors of Westphalia did. We must think about the other person rather than our own demands first. What are we doing for the other? What is we as a nation, as a people, doing for the other people, the other nation? And to build bonds of cooperation, long-term cooperation among peoples and nations on that basis. So we have to organize in coming out of this depression, which is now hitting us. We have to organize on the basis of a long-term 50-year approximately perspective for developing the Eurasian continent. Now, there's another aspect to this which I referred to the last time I had a Berlin assembly here. And that is, we've come to the point where there's a fundamental change in the relationship of man to nature. The growth of population and the increase of technology, improvement of technology, which is necessary for that growth of population, has created a situation where we are using up prime quality raw materials more rapidly than the planet can regenerate them. Now, we have entered also a period, the period of fission and fusion processes, at which we can actually regenerate, not only regenerate, high-quality raw materials, that is, help the biosphere recover from the damage of our consumption. We're also entering a period where we're going to create new conditions and new kinds of materials on this planet which never existed before, because we're going to go into the transuranic period of development of the planet, where we are developing new kinds of materials with new purposes, new compounds, new things we've never done before. We're going to have to meet the demands of the population, say, of China, over 1.3 billion, the population of India, over 1 billion people, 70% poor. How are we going to produce enough from this planet to meet the demands for power, for materials, for development of production of food? How are we going to do this so that we provide the people, the children of the people now existing in Asia, to provide them the opportunity of a standard of living which enables them to survive and improve? Therefore, we have entered a period in which we no longer think about taking over and exploiting raw materials. We think of taking over and developing the planet's equivalent of raw materials today, which means an emphasis upon largely thermonuclear fusion and related technologies. So the next 50 years will have to be that kind of transition. It means now a return to nuclear energy. For example, let's take the water crisis. We have on this planet a freshwater crisis. This is particularly true in India. Look, for example, at Southwest Asia. The essential crisis, apart from all the political problems in Southwest Asia, is a lack of water, a lack of potable water. Water for crop growth. Water for drinking. The wars, like Israel's war with Syria, was over water. Israel had an expanding population, had to steal the water from Syria and grab the water from everybody around there to meet their requirements. A water crisis. This is something we knew at the beginning of the last century, before World War II began. We knew that you could have no stability in the Middle East without development of fresh water supplies, without the change of climate by the application of power and water management to creating an environment which could support a larger population per capita in that throughout that area. We have in India now, in other places, we have populations that are living on what's called fossil water or semi-fossil water resources. You have water that's been stuck in the earth, down in a hole someplace, for over the past 2 million years of glaciation. The melting glaciers and so forth put water deposited like some kind of metal down there deep under the soil. And people are now, as in Australia, they're drawing water up that's fossil water. Or they're drawing water, as in the United States, the Ogallala Reservoir, that we're drawing fresh water from reservoirs more rapidly than they can be replenished at present. So therefore, we have a water crisis. We have plenty of water. You know about the oceans. Right? We have plenty of water. That's not the problem. But we need a quality of potable water for the development of agriculture, for greening and improving the climate by simply trees. Trees and grasses and so forth improve the climate. The more life you have in the ground, in the form of plant life, the better off you are, especially the green growth. So have it. We need that. We need fresh, clean, potable water for people. We cannot get that economically without the massive use of nuclear power, nuclear fission. India has a very poor population, 70%. It's a very poorly educated population, the 70%. Therefore, you have to find a lever to raise the standard of living when you don't have the educational base in the population for getting this through simply technology by people. So what do? You come in with nuclear power. You suddenly get an infusion of power and water, cheaply and efficiently. You change the conditions of life in which people live, and you increase their productivity by improving their environment as a productive environment. This is true in other parts of the world, as in the Middle East. We have to transform these areas to make them more livable, to meet the needs of their population today and tomorrow. And this must be the kind of mission we have over the next 25 and 50 years. So when we're building an economy, rebuilding an economy from the wreckage we've made of it since 1970 in particular, we have to think in these terms. We have to think two generations ahead. We have to think in terms of the Treaty of Westphalia. What are we doing for the other? What are we doing for Asia from Europe? What are we doing for other nations in Europe? What are we doing for Africa, the world as a whole? And therefore, in a sense that our life now has a purpose. We are not living like greedy baby boomers, trying to satisfy our own pleasure while we're still on this planet. We're now giving back a purpose in life, a mission in life. We all die. What's our purpose in life if we all die? Our satisfaction while we're alive? Or is it our what we're doing while we're alive with our life, which is of continued value for the human race afterward, that makes our life having been lived worthwhile for humanity? The thing that we can take pride in the eyes of our children and grandchildren, that we're doing for them and for the world after us. This is the passion which must grip us if we're going to come out of this mess. And therefore, we have to think in global terms, not in terms of globalization. We have to think of mission orientation for bringing nations together, to bring their own houses in order, to bring our relations among nations in order, to create a world system of financial and related cooperation, which is organized to meet these kinds of needs, and to give us, again, not the pride of arrogance, but the pride that we are necessary, each of us, and each nation, is necessary for the benefit of the world as a whole. That's the point we've come to. And that's where we stand now. Now, one of the problems here is that most people think they know something about economics. And I can tell you most people don't know anything about economics. They know what they've been taught. They know what they've been taught about money, money procedures. They don't understand physical economy, for example. And baby boomers particularly don't understand physical economy at all. Remember, the generation that was baby boomers, people in the upper 20% of family income brackets, now say between 50 and 60 years of age, 65 years of age, they don't have any understanding of economy. First of all, the 68ers, which they generally are, the 68ers were against production. It meant work, and they didn't believe in work. They believed in pleasure, all kinds of pleasure. And they picked up some pleasures, and it got them sick. And they got, so they went to a different pleasure. Or they went to sadism as a form of pleasure. So we have a society which no longer thinks in terms of real values. It no longer thinks in terms of immortality, in the sense of, are you an animal? If you're an animal, you come and you go, you die. You live happily or you live miserably, but you die. What's the consequence of your having died? Somebody remembers a pet, an animal you had on a farm. But what importance does that animal have as an individual to the future of the species? None. Human being, different. We are capable of reason. We're capable of discovering universal principles, as in physical science, in classical art. We transmit to develop these principles to coming generations. We thus increase the power of coming generations. We benefit the future generations of humanity. The baby boomer generation lost that. They didn't want to produce. They wished to have pleasure. They wished to have thrills. They wished to be able to ignore what was happening to the world around them. So we destroyed. We had the Green Revolution. Not the green in terms of vegetables, but the green in terms of I don't work, I don't produce. We live in a world where most people are starving and the starvation is increasing, and we don't care about what we produce or don't produce. We're indifferent to the rest of humanity. We think in terms of our greed and our pleasure, our lifestyles, our habits. We don't think of what we're doing, which makes us immortal in the sense of what we're contributing to the future of humanity. We've lost the sense of identity, which was the basis for European civilization. Formerly, we thought in European civilization of what we're doing for our grandchildren and those who come after them. People would sacrifice in order for the sake of their children and grandchildren and what came beyond that. They would sacrifice to build something which future generations could take pride that they'd done that. They'd built this. They'd accomplished that. We've went from a generation which thought of making contributions, of permanent contributions to the future of humanity, to one which was totally selfish. What I get, my satisfaction, my pleasure. And this is how we were destroyed. We were destroyed by our own sophistry. We wanted to be respected among people like ourselves, especially baby boomers. We didn't care about what happened to the rest of humanity. We wanted to beat them. We wanted to find somebody to beat, to get the better of them. We didn't, as people learned in the Treaty of Westphalia, after a horrible experience, that the way you succeed is taking care of the other person first. And that's how you build a civilization which has a future orientation, which is what we need now. The problem is that because people don't have the value that used to be the basis for a European economy, that is the idea of better production, better conditions of production, producing better conditions of life, better physical conditions of life, better mental conditions of life for physical production and so forth. A culture rather than just arbitrary pleasure. We've lost that. So we've lost the sense of what real value is. Value lies in what? Value lies in those kinds of ideas, discovered and developed ideas, which enable us to improve the condition of humanity per capita and per square kilometer of this planet, which gives a better world for a coming generation than we had. This is done by work, by producing things, by using more advanced skills, by increasing the power per capita to increase man's power in and over nature, by developing minds so people can think clearly. People today don't have time to think. They're too occupied with pleasure seeking or avoiding pain. So therefore, we don't think about a purpose in life. Therefore, we don't understand what an economic value is. Obviously, a physical economic value is what we can do today to improve the life of humanity in terms of developing things that are useful for the future, which means physical production of things that are useful for the future, and developing ideas which passed on to future generations will be used by them to make things better. So this is all tied up with what we call scientific and technological progress, and also cultural progress. For example, we're working with this question with a Bach. People have forgotten what Bach was. Some of them never knew. Bach was the foundation of civilization, modern civilization. His work in music, his work in counterpoint. His rediscovery of something which had been understood by the Pythagoreans a long time ago, the comma, which is expressed in great performances of choral works by Bach and by the great works of the classical composer, all based on this, which involves the same spark of genius in a different application than we have in the development of fundamental scientific discoveries. So what is important in a healthy society is the fact that you're dealing with ideas, whether in terms of physical scientific implications or cultural artistic implications, ideas which you are creating or improving in the sense of creating, which you pass on to future generations so that somehow mankind is progressing. Because the generations of the future will be more powerful and smarter than we are today in coping with the problems that humanity faces. And as we see, we have to have this because we're now coming to this point of raw materials crisis. We could no longer solve the problem we're facing today with the kind of approach to raw materials we had two generations ago. Couldn't do it. Without the development of the thermonuclear fusion technology and what that connotes, we could not deal successfully with the problems of this planet today. Without nuclear power, we could not deal efficiently with the water crisis of many parts of this planet today. So this process of progress, of scientific progress, of cultural progress in general, is necessary and is the essential value, the physical value, the real human value, which should dominate an economy as a sense of value. And what we put a higher price on, or what we value in money terms at a greater degree, should be those things that are of value to the future condition of humanity. Physical improvement in the conditions of humanity. Improvement in the physical ability to survive of human beings for future generations. The development of the human mind to a higher level of development of culture through cultural development, which gives us an individual who's risen to a higher level of outlook about man's position and function in this universe. These are the things of value. And what do you have now? The highest prices, the highest wages are paid to the most useless people, the predators. Whereas the people who are denied the right to work, even simple work, respectable work which corresponds to their given skills, they don't have the jobs. The opportunities for farming, in a traditional sense, don't exist where they existed. The opportunities for the machine tool designer, for the machine tool maker, for the maker of a better produced product. Most people are denied the opportunity to have that. Or you can have a job, a single euro job. But you can't have a job which has value for society, a job which gives you the opportunity to have self-respect for what you're doing in society, a kind of job that says, you are useful in my community. You have to be respected as a useful person. They don't have that kind of job. You look at the figures in the United States, as we look at every county of the United States, we studied, and we look at, in the county, how much employment and how much economic activity was for producing useful things, agriculture, industry, so forth, as opposed to so-called services employment, doing somebody else's dishwashing, being a waitress in somebody else's eating place, picking up garbage, doing odds and ends, make work. And you find a shift in the United States over the past 30 years from people who were productive, county by county, counties where the majority of people were employed in productive employment, to a situation where very few, a very small ration of the people in productive employment. And the people who supervise the useless employment are the people who get the biggest money. So therefore, there's a moral problem here. It's a problem of value. The problem of value, this term of value, has physical connotations as I've illustrated. There are physical benefits for humanity in this kind of production. Whereas simply pleasure production, which is prostitution and exemplifies, is not very productive. It is not intended to be productive. And that's our problem. So therefore, we have to have a mission orientation to organize this world around a sense of mission, looking two generations ahead, about 50 years, and saying, how can we get out of this hell we've made of this planet now? and say that 50 years from now, when the generation which is now becoming adults is approaching the age of nominal retirement, that that generation, having completed its two generations of work, 50 years, will be able to say, we have contributed something to the future of humanity. We have contributed to the benefit of the conditions of life of people in Asia. We have built up our respect for ourselves or what we're doing in Europe or in the United States. They have stopped these practices which we know are immoral and abhorrent. We have stopped this abuse of whole sections of the human race. And take that as an objective. And that's what we need. We're coming to a crisis. We're coming to a crisis of values. What people today accept as normal is rotten and evil. We have to change. We're going to have to change because we're going to be forced to change. We cannot continue to function the way we functioned since about 1970. We can't do that anymore in European civilization. We've got to change. And we're going to be forced to. If we don't change, most of the languages of the world will disappear as the nations disappear, as national borders disappear in globalization. That's where we stand today. Okay, I think we will get some discussion now.
I just want to make a couple of announcements. The following proceedings will be moderated by myself and Dr. Jonathan Tenenbaum, who is also a senior advisor of Executive Intelligence Magazine. And we will this time for sure have an opportunity to have people here in the room ask questions. There are members of staff here who have cards, and I would ask very much that you put down your name, your affiliation, or your institution, so that we could ask you to come up to the microphone. So just they will hand them out. The microphone is standing right there in the middle of the room, just so everybody can take a look at that. I think what's important to say is that the dialogue that Mr. LaRouche has started has been going on, obviously, for quite some time. And Mr. LaRouche answered some of these questions that were submitted already in written form in the last couple of days. So I would just like to mention very shortly, this dialogue is at a very high level. Among the people who have submitted questions are members of parliament, also from Italy, Andrea Ricci. He asked about the question of the new Bretton Woods system. And that's what the first subject of the questions will be. There's a question from also an economic journalist from Italy, Vitangeli is his name, on the question where he's asking about the collapse of the U.S. real estate bubble. And part of the written dialogue, there's a question from Professor Dai Lunjiang, who is the former chief economist of the Central Bank of China. And he asks Mr. LaRouche something along the lines of the direction that the International Monetary Fund is going and whether the International Monetary Fund represents an institution to change. But I would like to read one question, which I think it's more of a statement, and I'd ask you to comment on this. And this is from the former Secretary of State of the Argentine Republic, Julio Gonzalez. And he states the following. Mr. LaRouche, a coalition government must be established immediately in the United States in order to save the world economy. The political program of this new government must be to stop the expansion of wars based on oil, and those economic resources must be applied to building railroads over the entire globe, as your marvelous development project has indicated. Such wonderful plans will put an end to British supremacy and will stop their clash of civilizations intended to eliminate the world's population. How to do it? The philosophical and mathematical genius Blaise Pascal said once that power rules the world, but opinion based on reason leads power. With Lyndon LaRouche's world economic program to save nations, such world public opinion will be immediately established. Lyndon LaRouche, victory and future.
As you probably know, in Argentina, they have very few illusions of the type common to Europe. They don't believe the British are good. So therefore, they tend to be more objective about the world situation than many other parts of the world. But this is true. In we have a development about the crisis in Mexico now. Throughout South America, which is extremely important, because South America is coming out of the dirt after being put there from the 1970s on, increasingly over the course of the 1970s. And you have, with Lula, why, I don't pass judgment on Lula, but his re-election in Brazil is significant in the sense that it creates a solidification of a process of adjustment. I wouldn't say just cooperation, but adjustment among the nations of South America, which will have some impact moving north. They do want to develop. They do have practical ideas. The role of the current president of Argentina is extremely useful in this respect. He's taken initiatives in cooperation with other nations of South America, not just as Argentina alone, but in cooperation, which are really quite beneficial and very promising for the future. So what this gentleman expresses is, I find most agreeable. Thank you.
Okay, do we have a question from Washington? We'll see. Ready up?
Good morning.
Good morning.
We do have a number of questions from institutions here in Washington. Before I ask Lynn the first question, I'd like to just mention that there are a number of audiences, in addition to the audience in Berlin and here, gathered and participating in today's event. There are 5 university campuses in 4 cities in Bolivia. There are 6 universities in Colombia who are participating, as well as 3 separate trade union organizations, and we have an event ongoing in Argentina as well. Lynn, the first question comes from a senior staff member from the U.S. House of Representatives. It's someone who you know very well. Her question to you is this. She says, Lynn, during the 1998 economic crisis, then President Clinton and Treasury Secretary Rubin discussed proposals which sound very similar to those you are suggesting now for a new financial architecture. It was a very hopeful time for all of us. What happened to hinder their plans then? And how can you overcome renewed efforts from those who sabotaged a change direction in the past under what was an arguably more auspicious situation?
Well, there were 2 problems there. At that point, I was very much involved. This is particularly in August of 1998, because I'd seen this coming. This GKO bond crisis. And we dealt with in 1997 a similar kind of crisis, which George Soros was a sort of a figure in at that time. So we were prepared. I was prepared. And at that point in August, at a meeting of his own staff, President Clinton then just came to the conclusion that I'd been right and that they had been wrong in their estimate of the situation. And with his Treasury Secretary, Bob Rubin at the time, move to craft a sense of planning, which in the month of September came out in a meeting he had with the New York Council of Foreign Relations, a private organization. But he came out of that thing and didn't have a follow-up. The lack of follow-up was what he had done is he had actually threatened to bait the bear and hadn't followed through, and the bear began to strike back at him. And the bear strike back with a scandal and an attempted impeachment, we call bear facts, I guess, right? and attempted impeachment of the president. So that made a mess of everything. And the forces which were being mobilized by the president to act for a reform, monetary reform, were neutralized by this set of circumstances, as it often happens. I think that today that President Clinton probably has a clearer retrospective view of what the issues were then than he had then. I think he's clearer on this now than he was then. Unfortunately, he's not president. You know, we'd have a lot of problems that wouldn't have occurred to the planet if President Bill Clinton had a third term. We'd have avoided a lot of disasters this way. The past 6 years have been really a mess. So we're at the point now that either, as I've indicated today, speaking here today, either we go through a reform which reverses the decisions of 1971 and 72 to reestablish the modality of a Bretton Woods system. At that point, that does not mean we're going to simply go back to the Bretton Woods system, because at that time, when the Bretton Woods system was formed, the United States was the only currency in the world. And every other currency in the world depended upon the dollar. Today, we're not the only currency in the world. And therefore, but you have to use the dollar as a mechanism of organizing other currencies together for a fixed exchange rate system by agreement among a number of nations. That's essentially the change. Otherwise, it's the same thing. We have to put the thing through bankruptcy reform. We have to bankrupt whole banking systems to save them, not to shut them down, because they'll shut down themselves if we don't do it. They're hopelessly bankrupt. But we need the bank as an institution. Therefore, we're going to save the bank as an institution, not because it's worthy or because it's solid or something of that sort. It's made a mess. It's mismanaged. It's terrible. But we're going to save it because we need it. You need private banking institutions, and you need a national banking system to coordinate private banking institutions. That way you can resume economic activity without missing a step. If you try to start reinvent banking, you lose. So we're going to have to save the banking system, and we're going to have a general bankruptcy-type reform of banking systems in various countries together, simultaneously, by heads of government meeting and agreeing on these things. We have to reform the system. We have to create a new form of credit, government credit, because there will be no private credit net available. So it must be state credit. It must be long-term state credit by governments for assigned mission objectives for both public infrastructure and for private industry, agriculture and so on. On that basis, we can do just fine. So today, I think, looking from 1998 to the present, we can say we can take that as a benchmark, President Clinton's experience during the months of August and September that year with the GKO crisis, as a benchmark for what we have to do. But we have to add to that some very specific, positive, affirmative objectives in reorganization of the world system, because we're dealing with the world system. We're not dealing with just a U.S. crisis or a U.S. agreement with other states on a crisis. We have to create and design a new world monetary and financial and banking system based on experience. We have to design it quickly. We have to get agreement quickly. We must have agreement, for example, with China, with India, with Russia, with at least some nations in Europe, and the United States and some other nations. If we get that kind of agreement to a principled agreement, we can save this planet. If we can't get such a principled agreement, I'm sorry, fellows, we won't save this planet.
I'm Jonathan Tenenbaum. It's my pleasure to announce to you a special guest who came here this morning from Moscow, from Russia, Yuri Krupnov, who is a well-known expert on technology and on education. He's, among other things, the rector of the Youth Nuclear Energy Academy. He has just recently founded a new party, political party in Russia called the Party of Development. And I think some remarks that he could make to us could be very interesting in the light of what we're discussing right here.
Thank you. Distinguished ladies and gentlemen, I'm very glad to be here and right now to take part into discussion with outstanding economist and thinker of our time, Mr. Lyndon LaRouche. And I think that this discussion and all our speeches are important, first of all, because of our understanding that the situation in the world is very unique. Just now, we have not only the world finance and economic crisis, and I think that all people all over the world understand that the crisis is, and there is no any honest man who could deny it. But the more important that the situation is changing just right now. 10 years ago, when I was introduced to Mr. LaRouche, I thought that we haven't got any near future, and we haven't any opportunity to take part into economic development, to take part into political development, and to take part into world development. But just now, I think that we've got the main orientations and the main goals. We have the understanding of the situation, and I'm very proud to say that we've got a quite different Russia. 10 years ago, we, in my country, we've got a very strange crisis, because which was organized by the government itself. And when today Mr. LaRouche speaks about the government of the United States, which is on in the situation to destroy the United States, the situation is very similar. And to my mind, we should just now we should understand that at the same time, the situation is different because we know the experience of Russian so-called reforms. We know the experience of Asian and other crises. We know the experience of the last five very strange years of governance in the United States. And I think that the main problem just now, and which we understand this problem, is deindustrialization. Deindustrialization is the thing, the process, which is also organized, and we understand that there are actors which organize deindustrialization not only in some countries, but all over the world. And I think that the main idea should be how to stop deindustrialization and how to organize industrial development. To my mind, industrial development is not a problem of some country, any country. Industrial development is the main idea which could unite mankind and really give the proper aim for our actions and for our attempts to change the world. Just now in Russia we try to organize so-called coalition for industrial development, and this coalition is not for is not for political action, but first of all, it is organizing for uniting the industrial man and the man with industrial logic as with industrial mentality. Mr. LaRouche said very clear that today is not obvious for many people the idea itself that every man should work. And that should be obvious. And we should support every man, every industrial man, every man with industrial mentality who try to put their ideas and their mentality as a norm, a normal thing, and a norm for all people in country and for all mankind. I think that we should organize not only one coalition in Russia, but we should organize all world or global coalition for industrial development. First of all, it should be organized, I guess, here in Berlin. Jonathan Tenenbaum many times told me about the situation in Berlin, as which was the industrial center 20 or 100 years ago, and was very prominent industrial center, but just now has only 5% of its industrial capacities. And to my mind, is a great example what shouldn't be done in any case, in any situation. And to my mind, we should organize our coalition in order to change the situation in Russia, first of all, and in Berlin, and in any industrial center or in the city or in the country which had industrial capacities or would like to have it. And I think that the main idea, and I was very happy to listen to Lyndon LaRouche just today when he say about the dignity of man as a main idea of industry. We all know such an expression. It's economy, stupid. We are talking about economy. And Mr. LaRouche also is an outstanding economist, without any doubt. But to my mind, we are discussing here not economy, first of all. We are discussing the destiny of man, and we are discussing the dignity of man as the main goal for any political action in any country. So we should discuss quite another economy. We should distinguish between different economies. When we see some casino economy, this economy is not similar to economy of development, to isotope economy, which suggests Mr. Tenenbaum. And I guess that just now, we should formulate this mission and this idea that the dignity of man is the aim of any economy. And only such economy should be called as economy. I think that idea of development, and Mr. LaRouche said today about even world development, or development of universe, or development of all mankind, the idea of development is now such thing which should be implemented in such community like this. Because in conclusion, I should say that I'm very proud to be here and to listen to Lyndon LaRouche, which united people all over the world, but special people. So such people which like only to make any things which could develop the world. And this advanced community is development itself and should develop the world. I guess it's a mission, and I in Russia I'd like I make anything that could develop not only Russia but take part into world development. Thank you.
Perhaps I would add two brief questions from Russia, if you would like to comment. We had a question from Professor Eduard Afanasyev, who is the dean of the economics department of the Russian Orthodox University in Moscow, which he also asked his classroom for this question. So first question, what does Lyndon LaRouche think of the Nobel Prize-winning economists? Second question, what does Mr. LaRouche consider should and can be the role of Christianity in solving the present world economic and civilizational crisis? Oh, perhaps I just throw in the second question. This is by Alexander Nagorny, who is on the editorial board of a weekly in Moscow called Zavtra. It's a very well-known weekly in Russia. And he simply asked, Mr. LaRouche, what is your vision of Russia in general and Russia's role as a possible geopolitical and geoeconomic center and the future of the Russian currency?
Well, I don't think much of Nobel Prize-winning economists. I don't know of any of them who were competent. They generally have won their prizes for failure. That is, they have won the prize after their theory has failed catastrophically. So it's sort of it's a negative accomplishment. It's all like getting a pension. You're worthless, here's your pension, go away and don't bother us anymore. Christianity has a very specific kind of role. Now, first of all, that in dealing with humanity, we have to recognize we cannot shove religion down anybody's throat. As a economic policy and otherwise, but we don't have to. You have two great documents coming out of modern Europe which pertain to this question. The first one was by Nicholas of Cusa, Cardinal Nicholas of Cusa, who was the founder of modern science, as a matter of fact, revived it from his grave in various empires which had preceded him. And then in the Treaty of Westphalia, one of the things that Cusa did, of course, was his De Patre Fidei, which was the first ecumenical statement. This was in the context of the conflict between Christianity and Islam, in the context of the Ottoman Empire. At that time, he presented this De Patre Fidei as a ecumenical doctrine. Now, the ecumenical doctrine was of Cusa, then surfaced in the Westphalian Treaty of Cardinal Mazarin, his successor, as the great policy on which civilization in modern Europe emerged out of the bowels of over a century and a half, of religious warfare started by Tomas de Torquemada and concluding with the 1648 Treaty of Westphalia. So these two things are the lessons, I think, for politics globally. We're dealing with two areas of culture. We're dealing with European culture, which Christianity is a crucial part, the dominant part, or at least the cultural part. But we're also dealing with Asian cultures, which are by and large not Christian. And therefore, in this case, you have to go back to the ecumenical standard of statecraft, rather than a specific religious standard. And what you do is you take a religious belief like Christianity, for example, epistles of Paul in the Gospel of John, which are the most relevant from the standpoint of the Christian view of humanity as a whole, ecumenical doctrines as well. And you have to find the common ground. Now, the common ground, this is an important question, I have to keep it as short as possible. The common ground is the difference between man and a beast. The difference is not simply a distinction, like a brand label, which it often is treated as. The distinction is that man can think. Man can think in the sense of discovering universal principles of the universe. Man does not discover mere values. Man discovers universal values, as in a scientific discovery. Or, say, Johann Sebastian Bach's discovery of well-tempered counterpoint is not a novelty introduced to modern experience. It actually is the discovery of a universal principle, a principle of the universe. And that can be demonstrated. I won't bother here, but that can be demonstrated. And therefore, man's ability to discover or rediscover principles of the universe and to apply these principles to problems or challenges which confront man is essential. In Christianity, and Christianity's characteristic for this purpose is not only the mission of Christ, but it's also the mission of his followers, particularly John and Paul, from whom the understanding, the assimilation of the highest level of civilization at that time, which had been classical Greek culture. So from the distillation of the highest level of culture, which had previously existed, Christianity adopted, through such instruments as Paul and John, adopted an understanding of the distinction between man and beast, and of the universality of man as distinct from the beast. Now, what we must achieve in dealing with humanity as a whole, we're dealing with different cultures, not only different languages, not just the dictionary value of a language, but the connotations of the use of a language, the habits of use of the language by a people, the values of that form of language in the experience of the people. And it's through that medium that a people is capable of working together in the realm of ideas as opposed to words and objects. So therefore, it's essential, if you wish to have a society which is based on the will and participation of the people, you respect their language culture. Because their language culture is the repository of their communication about all kinds of values, including the deepest values. Therefore, when you're dealing with the factor of Christianity is values, you can only deal with that from the standpoint of taking what culture you represent and transmitting the values in the terms of the other culture to which you're addressing. So the approach has to be an ecumenical approach. It means an ecumenical approach in the case of Christianity of going to the most profound level of Christianity. Its conception is typified by the work of John and Paul as apostles. And proceed from that, as in the case actually Cusa did, and as actually in the case of the Westphalian Treaty. The Westphalian Treaty is based on 1 Corinthians 13, the concept of agape, the Greek concept of agape. So that value is universal. It's a part of Christianity, but it's also universal. And there are ways in which, say, a good missionary or an astute politician can carry universal values from his own language to the language culture of another people. And that's the way we should approach this. And in that sense, as our friend from Russia points out, Christianity does have a significant role in statecraft. This role for the Christian. We're trying to reach the mind, the values, as they may be experienced in the language culture of another people and a different religion. Ecumenicism. Now, on the role of Russia itself, Russia has some very interesting specific qualities, among which one is exemplary. You had a famous Russian who was once a prince and once a czar, known as Peter the Great. And he showed up in Germany at two occasions in particular, in one place, at a famous academy in the mountains of abutting Saxony. And there, from leaving there, once as a prince and once as a czar, he established academies of geology in Petrograd and Moscow. One of them has the tradition of the Vernadsky Institute in Moscow, Museum Institute today in Moscow. Now, Russia's achievement in physical science, especially in the areas of geology, is outstanding for the world. It not only is outstanding the world, but Russia represents a territory, both developed and undeveloped, which Russians know how to deal with because they have this particular kind of development of geology. Is how do we take this mass of land area, which contains all kinds of undeveloped mineral resources, as well as developed ones, with a hungry China, a hungry Asia to the south, which needs the development of raw materials. Russia has the ability, the scientific ability, lodged in the Russian Academy of Sciences, which also went through the evolution of being the Soviet Academy of Sciences and the Ukrainian Academy of Sciences. It has the ability to deal with understanding how we have to approach the management of the development of raw materials in these areas, which the rest of the planet needs, especially the population of Asia. So therefore, Russia has a very specific quality which is built into the Russian character and expressed in particularly in certain aspects of the academies of science of Russia as a tradition. They think better about this thing than anybody else on this planet does generally. And that's where they are outstanding. They also, you have the typical of this is the work of Mendeleev. Typical of this is the work of Vernadsky. And the ideas of Mendeleev, even though they were not completed by him, and the ideas of Vernadsky, which were not, also not completed by him, typify that the things in Russia, which are specifically Russian, culturally, which are of specific value to the rest of the world. Apart from that, Russia is also a Eurasian culture because of the history of its development. It has elements of Asian culture as well as European. So Russia is a Eurasian culture. Now, what are we trying to do? We're trying to bring together all of Eurasia over the next 50 years into a cooperative scheme of development. And Russia's particular value is being the Eurasian pivot which unites the function of Europe in Eurasia with the functions of Asia. This is typified by Russia's relationship to India and to China. And the time has come that the world has to recognize that Berlin, which is why one of the reasons I stand here today, that Berlin as the epitome of Western and Central Europe is the link to Moscow and other places in Russia. And Moscow and other places like that in Russia are the link of Europe to India and to China and other places in Asia and to the development of the natural resources in Asia, in Russian Asia and elsewhere, which is necessary for Eurasia as a whole. So Russia has a very nicely defined primary mission from the standpoint of the interests of nations which abut it. Thank you.
Debbie, do you have a question from D.C.?
Lynn, this question was submitted by the Clinton Foundation. It also reflects a whole series of questions on the same topic that we've just been bombarded with over the course of the last few days. The question is as follows. Mr. LaRouche, you have a long history as an outspoken defender of human rights, especially in the developing sector. At a recent event in Washington, D.C., former President Clinton addressed the current tragic situation in Darfur. And at that meeting, he voiced his support for an aggressive U.S.-led intervention to remedy it. We were very surprised at that time to learn from your spokeswoman that you emphatically disagreed. Given your record, we assume that you do not condone the current stance of the Bashir government. And since this issue is going to continue to escalate as a major strategic factor in the immediate days ahead, we would really appreciate it if you would explain your view of the situation both in terms of its cause and also of its remedy?
First of all, the problem is caused by the United States. The problem of Sudan is caused by the United States. It goes back to the time that, in this case, that the current president's father, who may wish to disown the connection, was a vice president of the United States. And he, with his wife, made a visit to the capital of Sudan and did some unpleasant things. But he was also involved in, as vice president, in what became known as Iran-Contra. That he was a key part in organizing what we call today Al-Qaeda, together with the British, because they've got people who are highly religiously motivated in the Arab world, especially from Saudi Arabia, and went to religious people in places such as Sudan and elsewhere, and recruited from Muslim Brotherhood circles, which were religious, people who were enthusiastic for this prospect, which we call Al-Qaeda, which was then what was the United States, organized at the behest of Brzezinski and company earlier, continued by Vice President Bush and by Jimmy Goldsmith of England and so on, as what was called the Afghanistan War of the 1980s. So in this period, the United States, in the person of Vice President Bush at that time, and others, had this grand war going over there. And they used people from the Arab world, particularly religious Arabs, particularly Saudi connections and so forth, for conducting this war in Afghanistan, which we are still experiencing at the present time, what they did then. It was a war on the underbelly of the Soviet Union, which was, in a sense, a bad idea. We had a better approach to this than they did to deal with this, the Soviet Union. And so in this process, that happened. Now, at the time that President Clinton was leaving office, and I think his administration had a very poor comprehension of Africa in practice, and I think I have a much better comprehension of the problems of Africa, though I'm not a perfect on this subject, than he does still, though I think his ideas have improved greatly, and I think his administration served him badly, particularly on the Africa question, as in the case of Uganda and so forth. I think he was very badly served by many people in his administration, the State Department at that time. And this is part of the problem. But I was last physically in Sudan at the end of January of 2001. And I ran into a buzzsaw. We were there doing work on the question of water. I'd been there a number of times before. Was very familiar with the problems in the country and the complexity of these problems, which this problem in Darfur is a reflection of, but it's a reflection of something else specifically. If you want to deal with the question, you have to deal with it honestly. First of all, the objective of some people is recognizing that the key to the whole area, from the so-called Lake Victoria, which I think is a name ought to be changed to some respectable name, all the way to the Mediterranean Ocean, that this area is governed now by a water agreement which involves Egypt, on the management of the Nile water. Now the imperialist objectives was to destroy Egypt. How? If you break the Nile water agreement, by splitting off parts of this microstate creations in this area, then you will break the water agreement, and then what will happen? Egypt will blow up. And the entire Arab world will blow up. So looking at these things as isolated human interest things is a mistake, because it is sophistry. It's ignoring the problem. Now, as I said, I was there in January of 2001. What I ran into was a buzzsaw. The Arabs coming out of Saudi Arabia, of Prince Bandar and so forth, were told the people in Sudan that they had a friend in George Bush, George W. Bush, and the George W. Bush administration. And I said, no. I said, George W. Bush is here to destroy your country. He's not your friend. But they said, no. The Clinton administration made a mess of the place. Bush is going to make it better. I said, he's going to destroy you. And it happened. It's been destroyed. Now, this crisis down there is a product of what the Bush administration has done and what the ignorance of the Africa question on the part of Clinton's own administration was. Clinton's own administration made a mess of Sudan policy. It was not the cause of the problem, but it made a mess of the whole thing. A failing to understand because of very bad advisors on this question of this area. And as I think the former president would recognize today, that some of his former advisors served him very badly on this question. And this mess is created by Bush. So why don't you clean up the Bush administration? And then we can settle the Darfur thing. Yes, it is a problem, but it's a problem which is orchestrated. You want to go in and treat this thing that you're going to solve the problem? You're not going to solve it. Not by those methods. You may think you have excellent intentions, but it's not going to work. You don't understand the area. And you have to understand this area. Not just by intelligence reports. You've got to understand the people. You've got to understand the history. You've got to understand Egypt. You've got to look at what some people thought about Museveni. You want to understand the problem in Darfur? Look at Museveni. And look at what the Clinton administration's attitude was on Museveni. Okay? This where mistakes were made. And the problem is the former president has to look at this way. You cannot be so attached to the idea of doing a humanistic act that in the course of doing what is ostensibly in the humanistic intention becomes a contribution to a disaster again. And that's what the problem is. People should listen to me and talk to me a little bit more about these things, and then they wouldn't make those mistakes.
So, my friend and colleague from France, Elodie Vieninot, I hope I'm pronouncing your name correctly, is going to take the microphone.
Yeah, good evening. I'm speaking here in particular from the presidential campaign of Jacques Cheminade, who's here with a small delegation of the LaRouche Youth Movement as we're campaigning there. We're very happy to be here at a moment which is completely critical, obviously also for France. And I have a question coming from, in particular, mayors who are mayors of villages and smaller towns of the country, who are those who can make it possible that Mr. Cheminade is an official candidate in the presidential election that is scheduled for April of next year. And in general, they are extremely disgusted with the course that our civilization has taken, what France has been doing, Europe in general, and are very distraught in terms of what they can actually do. And in general, the question is the following. As local and regional leaders, what can we expect from Mr. LaRouche and Mr. Cheminade's campaigns? And beyond signing for Mr. Cheminade as a candidate, what can we do from our grassroots position for your movement?
Well, there's several things that have to be done. First of all, as in all things, we have a generation of people between the ages of 18 and 30 who are not messed up in the same way that the older two generations are, the tweener and the baby boomer generation, as they call it in the United States and also here. That the baby boomer generation, apart from a few excellent individuals who are valuable, have been a disaster for humanity in their role in policy. You see, for example, you look at the 1980s, 1970s. We had, in the 1980s, things I was doing and things associated with me, what we were doing. For example, we organized major forces in countries around the world, such as France, Italy, Germany, and so forth, in major projects, strategic projects I was involved in. He's involved in an attempt to try to secure an avoidance of a collision with the Soviet Union at that time. But people were committed to that. When you go into the 90s, particularly the later part of the 90s as a whole, we're in a disaster area. Because what had happened is the generation which had been still leading governments in Europe and the United States, the generation that began to die out toward the end of the 1980s, was replaced by the baby boomer generation. And the policies have been an absolute disaster. The tweeners, take for example one case in the United States. The baby boomer, the 68er, was typified, especially the upper 80% of family income brackets, was by crass, the most crass immorality ever invented. It was Sodom and Gomorrah revisited, the 68ers. They were not a heroic generation. They may have fought against some things that were bad, but they created worse things than they fought against. Then they became sexual freaks. They were known for their sexual freakishness and other kinds of things. Their habits, their entertainment habits, their recreational habits in general. You had another generation that came along who were very poorly educated. They called the tweeners. They tend to become religious fanatics in reaction against the absolute immorality of their older generation, the baby boomer generation. So when you're dealing in politics in the United States or in Europe, you run right into this problem, that the baby boomer generation, that is the upper 20% of family income brackets, who are now generally in service between the ages of 50 and 65, are generally hopeless, morally, intellectually hopeless to deal with in dealing with any crisis situation. You have a tweener generation which is very poorly educated, which is raised in a post-industrial orientation of environment, has a very poor mooring in reality from a practical standpoint. You have a younger generation of young adults, 18 to 30 years of age approximately. There's some destroyed people, but you find in there a repository of people under the right conditions can develop and provide leadership for future society. They have no money because there's no money around. They have a very poor living standard. They come mostly from broken families. You know, it's very hard to find out who your daddy and mother were in that generation because their marriage habits were such and such. So with this kind of problem, and therefore, but today the key thing to focus upon is, can you mobilize to effective operation? Can you mobilize people from the 18 to 30 age group, young adults? If you can mobilize that generation or a significant part about it, you can then build a core of leadership which, like youth movements in the past of all European history, every important change in culture, in politics, in the history of Europe, has come from a generation of that age group of 18 to 25, 18 to 30 age group. They're adult, they think like adults, they have adult orientation. But they are open to change. It is the initiative, to take the American Revolution. The American Revolution, except for an old geezer like me, Benjamin Franklin, was largely people of this generation, youth generation, young adults. They made a revolution that shook the world, the American Revolution at the time. The same thing was going on elsewhere. And when the leadership of youth was bad, the revolution failed, or the progress failed. So we're at that point. So the key thing here is the organization and the recognition of all serious politicians, all serious political leaders and other leaders must recognize that the mobilization and development of the 18 to 30 age group as a force of leadership to inspire the rest of the population to move to necessary actions and decisions is the future of humanity. And nothing else will work. Nothing else will work. Everything else will fail without that factor. I work with this young generation, and I've seen them do things that the older generation would never dream of accomplishing.
So, Lynn, the next block of questions is basically on the situation in the United States, as you can well imagine. Again, this process of dialogue has been ongoing, so you have answered some of them in writing. There's a question from Colonel Eberhard Möschel here from Germany. perplexed about the situation in the United States. We've gotten many questions, one from different citizens here who are just saying, what is happening to the civil rights in the United States, and why are these being just accepted that the civil rights are being destroyed inside the United States? There's been questions on the Iran policy, et cetera. What I'd just like to very shortly, just very basically one sentence from the question from Professor Lokesh Chandara, excuse me, an eminent historian and former member of the Indian Parliament. He asks, do you view the aggressive policies of the present U.S. administration in alienating the vast sections of the world people? How do you see this?
You have to look back to the end of World War II. You have to look back to the point of the death of Franklin Roosevelt and the accession of his enemy, Harry Truman, to the presidency. Roosevelt's policy had been, from the beginning of his administration, and was a policy of a conflict with Churchill during the time of the attempted cooperation between Churchill and Roosevelt. Churchill, for bad reasons, took the good step of helping to break up the fact that most of the British monarchy was organized behind Hitler. And but for a few people such as Churchill, who Roosevelt managed to pull away from support for Hitler. Remember, the leadership of French banking, typified by Lazare Freya, Worms, and so forth, and Dieterding in the Netherlands, were Nazis. That's what they were. They may not have been Nazi party members, but they were behind Schock, and Schock was a Nazi. Schock was a master Nazi. He organized the Nazi party as a force for the head of the Bank of England. And the British were using, again, their intention was to use Hitler, originally, to have Germany go into a war against the Soviet Union. And then to have Britain and France fall on the ass of Germany, while Germany was deeply involved in the occupation of the territory of the Soviet Union. That was the original plan. The support of Mussolini, the support of Franco later, the support of Hitler, the support all came from Anglo, Dutch, liberal, and French syndicate circles in the continent of Europe. They're the guilty parties. Of course, at the end of the war, things were cleaned up. By 1948, the French fascists were all back out of prison and back in their old jobs in finance. Okay? That's the reality. So in the process, the issue between Roosevelt and Churchill throughout this war period was, as Franklin Roosevelt would have said, Winston, when this war is over, there is not going to be a British Empire. We're going to free these people. We're going to help them develop, referring to Africa and other colonized areas. The policy of the United States during the period of the war was the liberation of all colonial territories to become independent sovereign states and to develop with assistance from an American war machine which would be converted to producing goods, capital goods in particular, to help them develop. The day that Roosevelt died, Truman, who was a stooge for Winston Churchill and company, reversed the policy. Vietnam had been liberated. Indochina had been liberated by support of the United States, and Ho Chi Minh was the United States' ally in liberation of Indochina from French occupation. Netherlands was kicked out by a revolt, which the United States supported under Roosevelt, and so forth and so on. That the entire effort at liberating the colonial empire of the British, the French, the Dutch, and so forth, this thing was canceled. The peace agreement, which had been struck with Hirohito, was suspended. Why? So that Truman could drop two unnecessary nuclear weapons on Hiroshima and Nagasaki in order to signal to the world that the U.S. policy was the British policy of using nuclear weapons as a threatened weapon to be dropped on the Soviet Union to get the Soviet Union to give up, to join in world government, the elimination of the sovereign nation state. Now, that was the situation. And the problem today is that the fight is still that, except that we lost in the United States. The British faction in the United States took over. People think the United States is the problem. It is not the problem. There's a faction in the United States which is tied to the Anglo-Dutch liberal faction of Europe, the imperial faction, the faction behind globalization. That is the problem. And what is happening to the United States, in order to have globalization, you have to get rid of the United States. What is happening under George W. Bush and Lynn Cheney's dog, the president of ICE, what is happening is that the United States has, in 6 years, has discredited itself as never before in history. The world hates the United States, despises the United States, and says the planet would be better if the United States were to disappear. If you want to destroy an empire, to destroy it from the outside, you destroy it first from the inside. And if you think back to 2000, to November 2000, November 7th, you think back, what has been the change in the view of the United States from around the world since Clinton left office to the present day? The United States in the Middle East is being destroyed. By whom? By the United States. The U.S. military is being destroyed in Afghanistan, in Iraq. U.S. credibility in the entire area is being destroyed. They're now going to destroy Turkey. That's one of the next targets. By using the Kurdish issue, to split up Turkey. What do you think that's going to do? The threatened nuclear bombing of Iran is still on the agenda. The breakup of China is on the agenda. Wars against Russia are on the agenda. All seeming to come from the United States. The Orange Revolution is actually the Lemon Revolution. So this is how the United States is being destroyed. It's being destroyed as all empires are destroyed. If you can destroy them from the inside, you can then easily destroy them from the outside. That's what's happening.
So Debbie, you have a question for us?
Okay. When I mentioned the audiences that were gathered in Ibero-America, I failed to note, and I want to note most emphatically, that five important universities in Peru are holding gatherings where these proceedings are being monitored, and among them is the National Agrarian University in Lima, where we would like to extend particular greetings to Professor De La Vega and the new LIM chapter there. This is, I understand, the sixth LaRouche webcast that is being shown at that location. In terms of the additional questions from the United States, I thought we were doing a one-to-one ratio. It doesn't seem to be going that way. We have a lot of institutional questions here, so we're going to have to figure out how to deal with it. I will defer to a request from Berlin and ask the next question, which was submitted by Professor Jorge Hirsch from the University of California in San Diego. But I will note that we have a number of congressional and other questions as well. Dr. Hirsch says, Mr. LaRouche, given that the Bush administration has radically changed the U.S. nuclear weapons policies to make nuclear weapons more usable without consulting Congress or the American people, and it has explicitly confirmed that a U.S. nuclear strike against Iran is an option on the table, and this was explicitly stated in George Bush's April 18th press conference, and that the decision to launch a nuclear strike is solely President Bush's, I'd like to ask, what do you think the international community could do to help foreclose the real possibility that America would use nuclear weapons against Iran, which would have catastrophic consequences for Iran, for the United States, and for the world? For example, do you think it would help if our European allies demanded that President Bush take the nuclear option against Iran off the table as a condition for them to continue supporting our joint diplomatic effort on Iran's nuclear program? Or do you think it would help if Russia and China would ask that the U.S. make a firm, unconditional public commitment not to use nuclear weapons against Iran while Iran is a non-nuclear weapons state, in exchange for them agreeing to support sanctions against Iran if it doesn't suspend enrichment?
Well, the problem is that if you're going to fight war and you're going toward a global policy of fighting war, as the United States and Britain have done so far under the Blair-Bush alliance, then you're going to have any weapons that can be used will be used. And trying to get bans on nuclear weapons under those conditions is a waste of time. What you have to do is get at the root of the cause, and there are two roots. The first of all is the root of war. And the root of war is called, in this case, regime change. If you don't like what a nation is doing, overthrow its government, or else. And that's not really the purpose, but that's what the idiot says. I'm speaking of the president, who I speak of kindly by calling him an idiot. I could call him something else much more appropriately. Right. The problem is you have to eliminate the factor of war. Now, you cannot eliminate the factor of war as long as you have a Bush-Cheney administration. There's no way you're going to get the agreement. So why propose to seek an agreement with an idiot who will not agree to it under any circumstance? They will go to war. Look, what is Bush? You have to understand this clearly. People don't think sometimes strategically. They don't think globally. Bush is an imbecile, a mentally ill imbecile, a moral imbecile as well as an intellectual one. Now, why would someone like George Shultz take an idiot, a deranged, morally inferior person like George W. Bush Jr., and say to him, you're going to be the president of the United States? And the entire Bush administration was orchestrated by the same George Shultz who organized putting Pinochet into power in South America, in Chile, who also gave us the Operation Condor in the southern cone of South America in the 1970s, which committed one of the worst Nazi-style genocide using Nazi veterans to guide it. And this was done under George Shultz. Now, why would George Shultz, this ever-loving, evil totalitarian, want to stick an idiot, a congenital idiot, like George W. Bush, into the presidency of the United States during a period of crisis? Obviously, the tadpole is a tool. He's not really a political figure. The Bush-Cheney combination was put in to cause the United States to destroy itself and to clear the way for globalization by discrediting and destroying the United States. Because as long as you had a patriotic instinct for saving the United States as a sovereign nation, as a sovereign republic, you could not have globalization on this planet. If you destroy the United States, Europe has no guts. Western and Central Europe are gutless. Don't talk about what they're going to do. They don't have the guts to do anything really strong. They don't have leaders who'll do it. Leaders who might have developed were broken. My generation of Europeans might have done something. But they're dead, or almost dead. So they're not here to save civilization. You have weak, secondary leaders who don't have the guts or understanding to do these kinds of things. So therefore, there's only one remedy. It has two parts. Number one, get rid of the Bush-Cheney administration. Don't waste your time trying to improve what cannot be improved. Don't try to improve poison by giving it a better flavor. Get rid of it. Get the United States to immediately impeach these two clowns. Get them out of there. We have not had a double impeachment of presidents, the president and vice president. Let's have one. It's time we try it. The problem here is the wrong kind of thinking about war. What do we have to go to war for? I cannot think of any case in which we would want to go to war on this planet. I can think of instances where we might want to engage in military defensive action, which would be an act of war. But just in the sense that I don't like the idea of Desert Storm. But we know that at least George Bush the father was not as insane as George Bush the son. George Bush the father was advised and accepted the advice that after he had defeated Saddam Hussein in that engagement called Desert Storm, he would not try to occupy the country, knowing that occupying the country would lead to an internal revolt, which would lead into asymmetric warfare. And the United States had just gone through asymmetric warfare in Vietnam. They had seen the Russians go through it in Afghanistan. And by that time, everybody understood you don't start asymmetric warfare. So therefore, Bush did it. Why? Destroy the United States. Did Bush intend to destroy the United States? Who knows what he intended? What difference does it make? You don't ask a rattlesnake why it's poisonous. The point is, and people who are afraid, who don't see the possibility of doing what is necessary, what we need to do is get back to the idea of a Westphalian approach to politics. That we have to bring nations together, even badly behaving nations, by doing something good for them. Look, like North Korea. North Korea is not a pleasant place to live. But kicking it doesn't do any good. You make it desperate and mean. You starve it. You're not helping it. What you do is you offer something, as the Clinton administration was, in a sense, was doing. You offer the opportunity for integration, for economic development, for feeding its people, for building up industries. You take the enemy, in a sense, the foe, and you make him your ally. How? By doing something good for him. Because if you do something good for the nation, the government of the nation must sooner or later respond to the fact that the people like what you're doing for them. They don't want to fight you. What we need to do is have a policy as toward Africa. You have to have a policy. Our policy must be to care for the people of other countries and to do the things that we can do which will benefit them. And once they understand they're working on a beneficial basis with us, we can talk to them. We can conduct diplomacy. We have to be prepared in some cases to defend ourselves if one of these nations goes amok and starts to attack people. But we're going to behave the way that the United States behaved in Desert Storm. Once the issue of the fight is settled, the shooting stops and the reconstruction begins. So if you may have to use military force to defend institutions from aggression, but you do not use military force for regime change or to try to impose a regime or try to make an enemy by provoking it in order to create a pretext for attacking it. If the only solution is don't worry about how to settle these wars, don't have them, don't seek them, have good defense, which the United States has destroyed. The United States has no good military defense. We're like Israel, which is absolutely impotent. Israel just lost a war in Lebanon by its own stupidity and foolishness. What it did an aerial attack. That's all it really had. It made a mess of everything. Israel's about to be destroyed by itself by this kind of warfare. Right? So these are the kinds of problems we face. We've got to go away from this idea of conflict orientation to the idea of the Westphalian approach to treaty agreements with other nations. And I have, but also have, a defense if you need it. But don't use it except to put out the fire. And don't go any further than putting out the fire. Make friends, not enemies.
Debbie, do you have another question?
Thank you.
This is a question that was submitted by Jake Schechter, who's a political consultant here in Washington. He's involved in 50 key races for the Democrats around the country, and his specialty is policy development, both for the campaigns but also in the post-election period. He says, Mr. LaRouche, as it stands today, 1 week before this all-important federal election, we have a better than even chance of taking control of both houses. Although I do want to say that nobody should be overconfident, my own view is that we have not yet felt the wrath of the Rove Dirty Tricks apparatus, and you can be sure that it will be unleashed sooner or later. But for the sake of today's discussion, let's assume that the Democrats break profile and that we actually do win both houses. I like Jake. What are your instructions to the Speaker of the House of Representatives and to the President of the Senate in terms of what you think they should set as an agenda for the first 60 days of the new session?
Well, as he knows very well, you have two particular problems to deal with. Number one, you do have to try to bring Democrats together, but you don't let that hold you back from doing what you have to do. But you have sometimes to do some serious talking in your own ranks rather than giving anyone veto power in the sense of vetoing things which have to be done. You cannot have incompetence used as a way of compromise. We're not going to do anything to offend one of our own groups. Therefore, we'll come up with an incompetent decision. You're now in a crisis where civilization is about to disintegrate. You have no margin for making rotten compromises, even in your own ranks. There's some things you can't compromise on. What you do is you give away everything that's not important and trade it away in order to do what is important. Rotten compromise is no good. Giving away things which are valuable to you, but who are less important than the main things, mean you concentrate on the main things. And you may sacrifice some things which you think are important, but they're not crucial. Because you do have to, as a matter of fact, do have to get some kind of consolidation. The problem is the politics of the Democratic Party has been oriented to the upper 20% of family income brackets and to the money from the upper 3%. What's happened is the lower 80% has been essentially ignored or treated as an also-ran or tolerated at best. Now you've gone through a period in which the lower 80% is in a revolt. You see this reflected in, it was not the fact that you had sodomy was being practiced by and covered up in the House of Representatives or things like that. That was not what caused the thing. That was the trigger. The population wanted an excuse to break from the Bush administration. And the fact that a member of the representatives, Foley, House of Representatives, was caught with his pants down, made a good excuse for the evangelicals to break from the party. Because they already hate them. Because who are these lower 80%, including the evangelicals? They are people with children as boys in service in Iraq or returned from Iraq and can't get medical care. Of families which are destroyed by being sent to war in Iraq because the government doesn't protect them, doesn't support them. Economic conditions which are intolerable. There are every reason for the person in the lower 80% of family income brackets in the United States to hate the Bush administration. They're only their ideological factors like conservatism, fundamentalism, and so forth, have held them in. So now what you get, often people react, and you know this, people react not because they react on conscious issues as political issues. They may know the issues, but their political behavior somehow does not seem to register. But then you see they react. They react on a secondary or tertiary issue which expresses something to them which they wouldn't dare express by going directly or denouncing the party politically. That is the Republican Party or the ticket. So you have a revolt now of people who are suffering. Senior citizens, health care generally, of people over 50 years of age or 40 years of age, all have health care problems they can't meet. They're not covered. Whole towns are disappearing. Whole sectors of the country are disintegrating. The conditions of life of the lower 80% of the American people are miserable and desperate. It's coming into the upper 20% with a housing crisis. You're going to have a housing crisis, a collapse of housing prices, a mortgage-based crisis. Everything is being lost. They're suffering. Doesn't this suffering somehow find a channel to express itself? Yes, it does. Now, the Democratic Party's mistake is that it is oriented toward the upper 20% of family income brackets on the blue side, for political support, and the upper 3% for financial support. So how can they get the money to finance their campaigns? And how can they get the turnout from the upper 20% of family income brackets on the blue ticket? That's the issue. That's the problem. Why don't we look now at what they didn't look last year at all, at the auto crisis. Now look at the effect of the auto crisis. Whole sections of the United States are destroyed. The United States no longer has a U.S. auto industry. We have an auto industry in there. Japan, Japanese, French, so forth. But not in the U.S. You don't have the structure of an automobile industry controlled by U.S. forces in U.S. interests. And the auto and aerospace industries are the gut of a modern industrial society. You don't control the gut of your own modern industrial society. You don't have control of your machine tool capability. You rely on the good faith of foreign governments. No. And that's the mistake. What we have to do is correct the mistake. Look, in February of 2005, and March more emphatically, I emphasize you have to act now to save the U.S. auto industry as a part of a program of saving the United States economy. No, we're not going to do it. We're not going to do it. We're going to kiss the butt of Felix Rohatyn and other swindlers. Yes, we'll have infrastructure. We'll let Felix Rohatyn finance it. A fascist, the guy who financed putting Pinochet into power in Chile. That's where the problem lies. The problem of the baby boomer generation and the problem in the leadership of the Democratic Party is opportunism. But there's a better name for it. It's sophistry. We have to give up sophistry. We have to realize we're in a crisis. We're at a turning point in world history. We're about to lose the nation as a whole. Fiddle-faddling with trying to horse trade issues in the usual sense no longer makes sense. You have to think like Franklin Roosevelt. If you can't think like Franklin Roosevelt, keep your mouth shut.
So we have a series of questions that deal with the problems of the interaction between nations in Eurasia. The first one from Chandrajit Yadav, the former Union Minister of the Indian government from New Delhi. He says, Dear Mr. LaRouche, I agree with your assessment that the world economy is in a serious crisis. He says that one-third of the youth in the world are unemployed. The time has come for an alternative. The LaRouche Eurasian land bridge idea should be carried out as soon as possible. Then he says, however, there's a problem with that. Because the governments of the three Eurasian nations, which should be the most involved, China, India, and Russia, are not providing the required leadership for the land bridge. I think with the weaknesses of these three governments, we need a people's movement to support the Eurasian land bridge. And he asked for your comment. Would you like to make it now, or maybe I've had the other question? Yes, yes. I would mention that Professor Dai Lunjiang, former chief economist of the Central Bank of China, and his colleagues raised a couple of other points relevant to that. They talked about the problem of rivalries between China and India. They raised also the question of how to deal with the Sino-Japan relationship and in that relationship with U.S. policy vis-a-vis Japan. I would add to that particularly one question raised by the former vice minister president of Czechoslovakia and who was also the former justice minister of Slovakia, Jan Černogórski, who pinpoints the weakness of the European Union as a partner of this and says that we're threatened with a possible collapse of the euro. Would this mean a collapse of the European Union? What will happen with the European Union? And perhaps one last element put into this from Yadish Kapoor, who's a leading Indian intellectual and one of the co-chairmen of the Dialogue of Civilizations Forum from New Delhi, who refers to the failure of world policy, including U.S. policy, with respect to the use of nuclear energy for development purposes. So could you comment on that?
Go through these things. It's, now, the land bridge is the problem here is these countries, China, India, and Russia, do not yet understand the world situation. That's the problem. They don't have a sense of what the real issue is. They're looking at issues they do know, but in a context which does not correspond to the actual reality, the onrushing reality. They have, for example, China has not yet understood. They've improved their understanding, but they have not yet understood the implications of a collapse of the dollar for China. They know they're against it, but they don't understand that this policy as such, this U.S. policy, means an impossible situation for China. India does not understand that this means an impossible situation for India. So, and I, of course, on the Sino-Japanese thing that Bank of China friend mentions, this is something I dealt with otherwise. The problem is that the, remember that the reform in Japan occurred under the influence of the United States against the British and Dutch. So Japan would still be an Asian nation completely back with no industry to speak of except for the United States intervention during the period of the 1860s and 1870s. But later, the same Japanese emperor who accepted the United States' advice on the industrialization of Japan was won over by the British monarchy, which said to him, you are a monarch. The Emperor of Japan. We are the Emperor of England. We emperors got to stick together against the United States. Now, the British wanted to get rid of the United States influence in China. So what they did is they launched, under the Prince Edward Albert, they launched in 1894-95, they launched the first Sino-Japanese War, the aggression against China by Japan. That was followed by the occupation of Korea,
again an imperial acquisition, which was then followed by the Russo-Japanese War, which is orchestrated entirely by the British monarchy. The orchestration of this was done by Prince Edward Albert, was done in order to prepare for World War I in Europe. And then you had Nicholas II, who the fool, the Tsar of Russia, who was the nephew of the King of England, who made a treaty with the British and French on the Sykes-Picot Treaty on the partition of Iran. Now was fully in the business, and he lost his life. He lost Russia. So this is the kind of thing that has gone on in this period, and people fail to understand that the imperial policy, which the British government, the British monarchy, stuck into Japan against its friend, the United States, which is what caused the Pearl Harbor incident, which was organized by the British in the 1920s first, and then the British changed sides. Right? That this policy, today, as its reverberation today, and the conflict between China and Japan today, is a reflection of the continuing British influence in dividing the nations of East Asia against one another in order to control them. And the British influence in India is the same kind of problem. I was there. I was actually technically under the command of Mountbatten when I was in military service, U.S. military service. I was in the Southeast China, India, Burma, India theater. Mountbatten was the commander. I was in his service, and I was about to make a revolution against him. But anyway, that's another story. But this is the same kind of the problem today. So therefore, the failure to understand and to look back in history at least 100 years, preferably 200 or 300 years, to understand today, you must do that. Not just try to take the over-the-fence backyard issues of today. You don't understand it. What you need to do in a case like this, you have to rise above the issue, get to a higher level, define what are the actual interests of mankind, and propose an action which may have nothing to do with the way the issues are defined, but changes the subject completely. To say, let's not debate that. Let's not have that family quarrel. Let's talk about what we want to do that's positive. And that's the best way to solve these problems. The problem of the European Union, forget it. It's a coffin. Do you want to spend your life there? The European Union was set up to destroy continental Europe, to destroy every nation in continental Europe, and it's done a very efficient job at that. Look, here's Germany with tremendous unemployment, with lack of industry, and you have the occupying powers, chiefly Mitterrand and Thatcher, impose a European Union on the continent of Europe and then don't join it themselves. Because it's a slave ship. The British organize a slave ship, get the Europeans to join it, but don't come on board themselves. They sit outside and watch the fun. So here's Germany, which technically could, except for the European Union and the ECB and the Euro, which is a name for poison pill, they sit there, vast unemployment, decay of industries, loss of everything which Germany was capable of doing, hamstrung because it cannot create state credit to build up employment in the industries which are needed to bring the Deutschmark up to, or the equivalent, up to a balance. There's not enough productive employment, like Berlin itself, the city, is not allowed to become able to support itself with its own income. It is a permanent state of bankruptcy, when a solution would be obvious. The government simply says, build up the industries again. We've got an excellent relationship with China, India, and so forth, on Germany's relationship on behalf of Europe with these parts of the world, in Eurasia. Well, why don't we just do what we do? Here's the railroad center, Berlin. There's the access to the east. We've got tremendous markets to the east. Why don't we have the industries right here where we have the people? Build up the industries. Export to the east. We can put people to work. We can balance the budget of Berlin. Yeah? Germany can make money again. We can stop the 1 euro jobs and all this other nonsense. people can have a future? The German government could do that simply by creating intelligent application of state credit, but they can't. Why? Because of the European Union suit, which is the new form of the Iron Maiden. So we shouldn't really worry about that at all. On the nuclear power, look, the problem is very simple. The people have been sucked into the green revolution and globalization. In India as elsewhere. You find the problem is that, and the problem is that in other parts of the world. They don't want to fight the nuclear power issue, which anybody in India knows they need. India, of all countries, absolutely requires the immediate widespread application of nuclear power in 100 to 900 megawatt capacities. And required because of the nature of the country. It needs it. The water question alone requires nuclear power. You have to have dot the whole country with nuclear power plants just to deal with these problems. It's the only solution for India. Other people are not realistic. They're baby boomers. They think about not what you eat, but how you feel about eating is what's important.
So, Debbie, do you have a question from D.C.?
Yes. Before I ask the question, we did get a communication from Peter Ruffino from the University of Chicago Law School. He said, Mr. LaRouche, thank you for your remarks regarding the impeachment of Bush and Cheney. As I'm sure you know, House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi, who hopes to be the Speaker of the House in January, has repeatedly made public pledges that if the Democrats win control of the House, that she wants to make clear that impeachment of this administration is off the table. I drafted a letter to her asking her to withdraw that pledge, in which I outline a series of already documented impeachable offenses by this administration, even prior to any substantive investigation by Congress. As of today, over 150 leading constitutional law experts have added their signatures to this letter. I just wanted to use the opportunity of this webcast to invite any American law professors who are listening to this broadcast to join in this effort. I don't know if he wants me to give out his email address or not. If there are such people listening who would like a copy of the letter and who would like to participate, perhaps the best thing to do is to respond to the web address of LaRouche Pack, to the email address of LaRouche Pack, and we will forward your name and information to Dr. Ruffino, and he can contact you himself. The question that we have is a question that was submitted by two senior members of the professional staff of a leading Democrat who, if in fact the Democrats do win next week, will be the chairman of a major committee in the House of Representatives. And again, they are charged with trying to draft policy for the immediate period ahead. The question is as follows. Mr. LaRouche, you have spoken and written a great deal about salvaging the American manufacturing sector for national infrastructure and defense purposes. In this sense, America would produce things that it would purchase for its own purposes. But what about salvaging a manufacturing sector that still sells to the rest of the world? How can American manufacturing regain a competitive edge in the world's marketplace? And how important are core labor standards to that project? And if you think they are important, how would you suggest that we make core labor standards enforceable around the world? This question could just as well be about German manufacturing or French manufacturing, or really the manufacturing sector of any highly industrialized nation, facing competition from other countries that simply do not respect fundamental workers' rights.
Well, you've got to put some teeth in this issue. Now, the problem, the mistake is to assume that we go to manufacturing jobs as such for export. That would be a mistake. It's not a mistake to export manufactured product. That's not the mistake. The point is people have to understand the composition of the process of production and how an economy works as an economy. The problem the United States has, the thing that tends to drive up the cost of production, is the lack of basic economic infrastructure. Look, the United States wastes a tremendous amount of money on building highways. You may have seen our superhighways. They're called parking lots. At every rush hour, parking lots. You see the congestion of moving populations around a few centers which have superhighways used as parking lots at rush hour time, and rush hours go on 6-7 hours a day. There's something wrong here. We've gone in the wrong direction. What do? We destroyed infrastructure. The way you have to look at the United States economy, and people have to rethink, don't listen to what the accountant says. The accountants don't understand economics. That's why they're accountants. They flunked the economics. The problem here is to have a productive industry, you must have an economy which is productive. You measure productivity per square kilometer and per capita. You measure it for your total average territory. You develop private agriculture, farmers, real farmers. You don't destroy the hedgerows in order to have cheaper farming for mass grain production. You don't do all the stupid things to destroy whole states, whole sections of state, by deindustrializing them, by destroying agriculture, by destroying education, and then having a few large areas and taking the average as if you're making some gigantic soup as opposed to an economy. Where we've lost it, we don't have power production. We've lost whole sections of the country in terms of power production. You can no longer get drinking water out of a faucet. You buy bottled water. Or you get a disease. You got a choice. We don't have schools, health care. We don't have the infrastructure which supports a highly productive population with the means of production which infrastructure provides. Therefore, the way you build an economy is the way economies were built well in the past, in European systems. You develop an economy by developing the people, education, sanitation, healthcare, the people. You develop the communities in an organized way. You emphasize private corporations, not large corporations. You don't ban large corporations, but you don't want to consolidate conglomerates. What you want is you want the entrepreneur. You want the typical German entrepreneurial firm. For example, let's take the case of MBB in Germany, which I had some acquaintance with some years back. MBB was the aerospace center of German industry. It was very highly developed, with 10,000 people worked in engineering design. The industry was destroyed by Reuter of Daimler-Benz. And Germany, and this was a firm which not only had about 10,000 people in that category of work, but which had relations with small shops all over Germany. We had a physicist with two people, this kind of firm with 25 people, which were subcontractors. We were the repertoire of firms such as MBB. And people at MBB who want to make a product knows this guy over here, they can call him in to assist them with any particular problem they have to solve. And therefore, the private firm, the small, closely held private firm, the Mittelstand firm, is the essential part of any well-organized economy. And Germany was the pillar of this kind of development in former times. It's gone, or it's going. There's a little bit left of it in Bavaria and a few other places, but it generally is going. It's insane.
And what that means? It means you have communities which have diversified characteristic, different kinds of industry in the same area, a great dependence upon things like the Mittelstand for these industries, a few larger firms which combine the work of a lot of Mittelstand firms together with the process of making the components, which make the final product. And you have a nervous system. We can go into one firm, say a key firm, we want to do this. Well, they say, we got this firm, we got this Mittelstand, this one here. We can put it together. That was what Germany used to be able to do. That was a high-quality product. That's what the United States used to be able to do. By depending on these small firms, you know, 5 to 100, 200 people, which were specialized firms in technology. And large firms who wanted to make an automobile, an airplane, and so forth, could rely upon these firms to do the testing and design work, and you got a product. And that's what you want to do. Now, therefore, we don't have that structure. If we want to build an industry which is competitive with the world market, the United States could do that. But what it would have to do, it would have to start by building infrastructure, which is what I emphasized last year. I said, take the auto industry, don't let it be shut down. Don't close it down. Leave it alone. Keep it there. Convert the part of the auto industry you aren't going to use for automobiles and don't need. Convert it for infrastructure. We can build locks and dams. We can build all kinds of things which are necessary for infrastructure and build us back an economy. Use this auto industry with this machine tool capability. Use the same plants in the same places. That's the way it works. Like Lockport, New York, had a plant up there, Delphi. The plant had produced all kinds of things, aircraft. It could produce components for water management systems, canal systems. It's on the St. Lawrence. It's on the Great Lakes. It's connected to the Ohio River. You can move your product down the very rivers in which it's going to be used for that kind of production. The space industry used to have the same kind of ability. So what we have to do is build up the productive potential per capita of the United States per square kilometer. Therefore, don't worry about being competitive in this area, this area. Don't let the accountants talk to you on this one. Get your engineers, get the scientists, not the accountants. And go calculate physically, per capita, per square kilometer, how much productivity and how competitive is it in terms of technology. Build it up. If you do that, and you turn the ingenuity of the entrepreneur loose, not the large corporation run by the papier-mâché accountant, but a real man, a real human being, who knows production. Turn him loose with his firm. Let him fight for his market. Help him. And you will increase the productivity of the United States the way we did under Roosevelt, under comparable conditions. That's the way to do it. It's the way to do it here. Germany is the ideal comparable example to what we can do in the United States. You just do the same thing. So that's what we have to do. Go to my program. The way I said, we still have some of the plant facilities. We still have the personnel who are put out of work. The communities that were shut down by the stupidity of the Congress in allowing this to happen. Put these people back to work. Create a government corporation. Create the funding of a government corporation. Take these things over that are being idled. Put them under government protection. Get them moving again. And move them ahead to the point they become self-paying operations.
So we have a question here from the audience. It's from Mr. Jihad Yakhan. He's an entrepreneur here from Berlin, originally from Syria. He'll ask the question in German, and then I'll translate it.
Herr LaRouche, Sie erwähnten, dass George Bush Politik die USA zerstört. Was ist Ihre Rat für Deutschland, Kanzlerin? Mit dem Hinblick, was raten Sie dem Regierung Syrien und Iran, den Frieden bewahren wollen? Danke.
Mr. LaRouche, you mentioned that the policies of George W. Bush are destroying the U.S. What is your advice for the Chancellor of Germany? In this respect, what is your advice for the governments of both Syria and Iran that wish to preserve peace?
It's something I'm working on, getting rid of the Bush administration. Because if we don't get rid of the Bush administration, nothing's going to work. The United States will be destroyed. I mean, if you keep taking poison, you may die. If the United States keeps taking the poison of the Bush administration, it will die. It will die very soon. We're going into a crisis. Remember, I said at the beginning today, this event, I said we're already, as of the middle of September, we've gone through a phase downshift in the U.S. economy, which means that the U.S. economy and the world economy is about to go into a chain reaction collapse, a collapse which potentially is comparable to what happened in Europe when the House of Bardi went bankrupt in the middle of the 14th century and Europe went into a dark age. We're in that kind of situation. You have an economy which is based on managements which in the large degree are totally incompetent, by governments which are incompetent in the matter of economics. That is, they've lost the kind of competence that existed in governments, say, in the 1980s and the 1970s. They've lost that competence. They don't know how to run anything except run it down. Every policy they make is generally a mistake. What we have to do is two things. We have to have a mission orientation ourselves, that we're going to go back and become what we should be, and that we are going to get rid of governments that refuse to make that kind of reform. And we will be able to do so because when everything is falling apart, as it will be very soon, in every leading government of Europe, you're going to find governments of Europe are going to suddenly disintegrate the minute the weight of this tidal wave of collapse hits. And you'll find governments which will disintegrate, which you think are strong governments and good chances of being reelected today. You're going to find that those governments are going to disintegrate before your eyes. So therefore, you have to take a completely fresh view of the situation, knowing, as I said at the beginning today, we're in a time where things are going to change very suddenly, very soon. Anything you think is established habits or traditions in your area, don't trust it. It probably will fail. We're going to a revolutionary period of a crisis beyond belief. You have not seen in the past century anything like this. The closest was what happened in 1923 in Germany to what's going to happen now, what's going to happen on a broad scale. So therefore, what we have to do in this area is decide we're going to do that. We're going to change the government of the United States. We're going to have a positive policy toward relations among nations. We're going to be looking for economic development in terms of industry and related things and infrastructure. We're going to base relations on trying to find ways of utilizing the desire to cooperate in economic sphere wherever possible. We're going to negotiate the way we used to, is to negotiate projects, which are projects which through financial agencies such as new banks organized in a new way, just fresh start banks, to fund contracts with the aid of government-to-government agreements, treaty agreements, which cover certain projects among certain nations. And that's the way we're going to do it. You take the case of Iraq, Iran, but it's no problem. Iraq is a problem because the country is being destroyed, disintegrated. It's very hard to rebuild a country that's being disintegrated. But if you rebuild around it, for example, if you use Syria, which is next to Iraq, use Iran, which is next, if they're both proceeding healthily, if Lebanon is being reconstructed, if you get the Palestinian crisis under control and start to give the Palestinians some opportunity, some hope for some kind of relief, then you have an environment in which you can introduce treaty agreements to sponsor economic development. Under those conditions, yes, it'll work. The opportunities in Iran are tremendous. Maybe not tremendous on some scale, but relative to the area. It's got 70 million people. Some of them have a high degree of technology, culture. You can do a great number of things there. And it's a good opportunity. But you need to have the agreement among governments to provide the protection to enable this agreement to go forward. The need for the market, the need for the jobs, the need for the economy is there. The incentives are all potentially there. But you need to have governments agree. And to do that, you have to get rid of the Bush government. Thank you.
So, Debbie, you have one more question. This will be the last question from D.C. then.
Lynn, we still have a number of institutional questions that we will submit to you, and perhaps you can answer in writing. They include questions from here in Washington, but there are also several questions from some key labor leaders in Argentina, and there are a couple of institutional questions from both Africa and from other nations on the Ibero-American continent. But what I'd like to do is to make the last question here from the Young Democrats from a community college in Missouri. There were about 25 of them who gathered to listen to the webcast, and Bobby Steerwald submitted this question for you. He says, thank you for calling us to seek justice by doing all we can to preserve the lives of those around us. You call for justice and love, and you referred to Apostle Paul in Corinthians 1:13. Now, admittedly, Bill Clinton is a baby boomer, and he did enjoy a lot of controversial pleasure while he was in office. And I guess he was impeached for lying under oath. But you said that it would have been useful if he had served a third term. What of his specific policies would you want to have seen continued and developed if, in fact, he had a third term in office? I think this is important from the standpoint of the immediate political period ahead.
In this case, I think the important thing is the man and not the policies. The valuable part about Bill Clinton is that he's extremely intelligent, which none of his rivals, approximate rivals, really are. And he is capable of changing his policies on the basis of being intelligent. See, most people are like, most politicians are like wind-up toys. Whatever they're built to do is what they do, whether you wanted to do it or not. The valuable politician is a statesman, who is not a politician, but a statesman. The statesman is the person who starts from a standpoint of a conception of care for the country and care for the humanity as well, and who responds to not only what he sees, but what he foresees, who concentrates on getting advisors, specialists, who will help him foresee what is coming down the road, who will help him see what the options are for dealing with each of the problems he's thinking about. He functions not as a politician, but as a leader. A person who's groping into the future and knows how to do that job of groping into the future. A person who knows how to change, who knows how to develop and respond to the situations as often as possible before they happen. Now, Bill showed through his presidency and through what I've seen of him since he was president that it continues to grow, as very few leading American politicians do. They may improve slightly, but they don't grow. Bill has been growing. And therefore, had he had a third term, I'm sure he would have grown even more than he has being out of office. But he's shown to me growth in being out of office. He does have a streak of outward opportunism. I think in that sense of his opportunism, which he would explain otherwise, and I understand that, is that underneath the opportunism, there's a man who cares. And there's a man who wants to find the real answers. Who, in the short term, will try to politically maneuver his way through a situation by gathering support by being an opportunist, a baby boomer in short. But he comes by that honestly. He is, after all, a baby boomer. But at the same time, underneath there's a man who can think, who has a sense of history, who has a sense of a historical perspective in respect to the things he does or chooses, which he's committed to whether he says so publicly or not, but what's working in his mind behind the scenes. Now that he is, in a sense, with all the faults I might find in him, he has that quality of the statesman. And there are very few of his generation who actually do. So I take Bill, with all his faults, and say, well, but that's plus. You want to criticize Bill? Look at what the competition is for his position. And you come back to Bill.
So we have many, many more questions, but unfortunately we just don't have the time today to be able to ask Mr. LaRouche directly. But of course, all of these questions will be forwarded to him in written form. As a last question, Portia from the LaRouche Youth Movement here in Berlin has something she wanted to ask for Lynn.
Hi, Lynn. We're having fun here tonight. Actually, parallel to this meeting, intervening on some suckers from the DLC who wanted to sabotage tonight's meeting. But in fact, I think we're having a lot of fun in Berlin at all in the past period, warming it up for a revolution. My question on behalf of the LaRouche Youth Movement and also on behalf of young people gathered around the world is, with the great danger and the great promise of the period of history we're in. I mean, it's hell or what you're proposing, basically. I've come to realize the necessity of a whole generation, my generation, to more and more think like you, mastering your discoveries and the implications of them on the past, but more importantly, on the future. And we have very few role models today. So could you give us some pointers or rather marching orders?
Yes, we have a project which I've started in the United States because I started it because I saw that the youth movement's education program, while useful in respect to getting into some of the features of spherics, for example, and a few other things, was very useful. But I was not getting the kind of thrust, continuity, which is needed. So I said, we're going to scrap this. We're going to do another program. So I took three phase questions out of largely Kepler. First of all, to reenact Kepler's discovery of gravitation. Not to learn how to repeat it after me, but to reenact the act, to go through the mental experience of Kepler, because Kepler writes what is happening to his mind. He doesn't change it. So you can, by studying Kepler's works, you can see how his mind was working at successive stages in developing an idea. Very unusual. Very few writers do that. Very few scientists have done that. Secondly, Kepler is the founder of modern science. The design for the founding of modern science was by Nicolaus Hakusa. Contributions were made by Leonardo da Vinci, very important ones. But it was Kepler who first took the question and made a universal approach to science and modern science. All modern science that's successful comes out of Kepler. If you relive Kepler, and two of his discoveries in particular, and a third one by Gauss. First, the discovery of the principle of gravity, which no English-speaking person even ever knew until recently. Secondly, the discovery of the organization of the solar system. Now, it's even more than that, because the discovery of the solar system is the discovery of the fact that the universe is not entropic. That is, the astronomical system is not a fixed system, because the sun was all by alone in its corner of the universe, all by itself. Nothing there. It was spinning fast, spinning rapidly around, looking for something. Couldn't find anything. So it made something. It spilled off some plasma. When it was fast spinning, this plasma took the form of a plane plasma, looking pretty much like the image of Saturn with all its moons, the rings. This material spun off, And in it, you begin to see that there's fusion occurring, going from the limited number of elements you find in the sun, outside, there are more elements are being created by the sun, by radiation from the sun impacting upon this plasma. And then some years ago, I decided this had to be polarized, because you couldn't get the table of the 92 elements without polarization. Then it would work. So here's a polarized plasma spinning off this material. This material is spun off into, like, distillation, planetary orbits, one after the other. They have certain characteristics in common. They never lose their connection to the sun. Even stray bodies that come into the planetary system are locked into that system by the sun. And this has an ordering. Now we have thermonuclear fusion, which is what the sun was already doing. So thermonuclear fusion is a universal principle. It's not something that happened and then happened. It was there in the beginning. The universe is not a fixed creation. It's a developing creation. The world is anti-entropic. The universe is anti-entropic. It's creative. And our minds are creative. We are in the image of creation. We're the personification of creation. And our duty is to develop, not to do the same, but to do something different, to move forward, to make the next step up. That's our destiny. That's what we existed for. And that's what we have to make it our morality. We never try to perfect ourselves to sit in the same corner. We never allow ourselves to do exactly what our parents did and grandparents before us. We must do something new, something better. Not to throw away what they accomplished, but to build upon it, to build a better future. And in Kepler, you've got that. In the way he approaches the discovery of gravitation, that's already takes you someplace. But then, the way the organization of the planetary system spun out and created by the sun around it, then you have a third case, not done by Kepler, but done by the effect of Kepler. Kepler, in looking at the harmony of the system, saw that there was a missing planet in the system, a missing planet in a location of dissonance. And so then when Gauss saw some phenomenon with a few pieces of 41 observations of something, that's all he had, from 41 observations, he discovered the orbit of the first asteroid, Ceres, which had the characteristics which belonged in the Keplerian harmonic system. Once he saw that, he knew that this was an asteroid, not just some stray piece of garbage out there. It shows you the importance, the understanding of the relationship of these characteristics of universal physical principles and how they're derivatives and how they apply to reality. Then you go on to the final stage, beyond that. You come to the work of Riemann, Bernard Riemann. And as Einstein said, but nobody seemed to understand what he was saying. He said that modern science begins with Kepler, who was valid, and it continues through Riemann, who completes the cycle of the definition of what modern science is. So I have these young guys working on these successions. Start with gravitation, Kepler. Get to the organization of the solar system, Kepler. Realize the implication of Kepler's discovery, the asteroids by Gauss. Then go beyond Gauss to the realization of the implications of Gauss. And then you get to Riemann. Riemannian hypergeometry, a physical hypergeometry, not a formal one. Now you know everything essential about the entirety of modern science. You can think like modern science. You don't know just a few things. You're not a guy who can babble off and say, I know this thing, I know this thing. Now you have a sense of how the universe works and how man works in the universe. We need a generation of youth that thinks like that. Not that mean everybody of that age group is going to think like that right away. But we need in society a core of young people who, in their search for an education which they can't get even if they could afford it in the university, need an education. We need an educated population. We can't afford the prices of universities anymore. Not for many people.
We can't leave, we can't throw people into a ditch because they can't afford the price of university education in a, at a university where they can't get an education, no matter how much they pay for it. Therefore, we have to educate them. So we go economically. We take a core program to identify the greatest central achievement of European science. We say, you know this. Know from Kepler to Riemann. Know that. And then branch out from there to the next stage. Yourself.
So, unfortunately, we've come to the end of the meeting today, but fortunately for us, Lynn has given us a lot of work, so we'll have a lot to do in the next weeks. And if I'm not mistaken, there is a webcast on November 16th. Is this correct? And this is now the clear date, November 16th, from Washington, D.C. So I know everybody will be watching, and there'll be probably thousands of more people because of the result of the American the elections in 1 week, and therefore what Mr. LaRouche has to say on the future of humanity based on these election results. So with that, I'd like to end the event here, and of course, thank Lynn very much, and we hope to see him here in Berlin as soon as possible again.